Rachel T.
Hi, I'm Eva.
Hi, I'm Rachel G.
We are all Girl Scouts, and this is WGXC ACRA.
Moments before he's hit with a 40-foot wall of sulfuric acid that will horribly burn everything in its path. Now, that's real acid, so I want to see goggles, people.
My eyes, the goggles do nothing.
It's almost always safety first at the Thingularity Radio program, so don't let that happen to you. Have your questions answered by sending them to catskillmakersinfo@gmail.com and tune in.
Ladies and gentlemen, brothers and sisters, friends, and enemies, you're listening to WGXC, Radio for Open Ears, 90.7 FM in the Hudson Valley, WGXC.org, and most of the rest of the world. You're listening to me, your host, Norman Douglas, and the name of the show is Good Night, Norman. Tonight, Herland, an excerpt therefrom, first novel excerpt I read on the show. before that, I should ask you to donate, because the pledge drive is coming up, to WGXC. Go to the website, WGXC.org, or wavefarm, one word, .org. Click the donate button. You'll see all the info on how to donate by check, by Venmo, that's at wavefarm. PayPal. You can also do a monthly thing, anywhere from $5 on up. That'd probably be really groovy. You can even donate stocks and securities, cryptocurrency, checks, credit cards. You can mail cash money. There's some predetermined currencies you can choose from for a one-time donation. You can make a dedication with that donation. You can do all kinds of things. One of the things you can do is support this community radio station, which has been broadcasting originally from Hudson since 2008, if I'm not mistaken, 15 years. Okay, now that I've said that, Herland is written by Charlotte Perkins Gilman, was published around 1915 as a serial in a magazine edited by the author between 1909 and 1916. Rather than give you my rambling plot summary of my own, I'm just going to read to you from Wikipedia. Plot summary to the point where I'm beginning. Stories told from the perspective of Van Dyke Van Jennings. Excuse me, he's a sociology student who, along with two friends, Terry Nicholson and Jeff Margrave, forms an expedition party to explore an area of uncharted land rumored to be home to a society consisting entirely of women. These three friends do not entirely believe the rumors, because they're unable to think of a way that human reproduction could occur without males. They speculate about what a society of women would be like. Each one guesses according to the stereotype of women he holds most dear. Jeff regards women as things to be served and protected. Terry views women as things to be conquered and won. When they reach their destination, they proceed with caution, hiding the biplane they arrive in, trying to stay hidden in the forest bordering the land. They're quickly found by three young women who they realize are watching them from the treetops. After trying to catch the girls with trickery, the men end up chasing the women towards a town or village. The young women outrun them easily and disappear among the houses, which Van, the narrator and lead character, notes are exceptionally well made and attractive. After meeting the first inhabitants of this new land, which he dubs her land, they proceed more cautiously, noting that the girls they met were strong, agile, and completely unafraid. This caution is warranted because as they enter the town where the girls disappeared, they become surrounded by a large group of women who march them towards an official-looking building. They attempt an escape, but are swiftly and easily overpowered by the women and anesthetized. They awake and find themselves captive. Thus begins chapter 3, A Peculiar Imprisonment from Berlin by Charlotte Perkins Gilman, 1915. From a slumber as deep as death, as refreshing as that of a healthy child, I slowly awakened. It was like rising up, up, up through a deep, warm ocean, nearer and nearer to full light and stirring air, or like the return to consciousness after concussion of the brain. I was once thrown from a horse while on a visit to a wild, mountainous country quite new to me, and I can clearly remember the mental experience of coming back to life through lifting veils of dream. When I first dimly heard the voices of those about me and saw the shining snow peaks of that mighty range, I assumed that this too would pass and I should presently find myself in my own home. This was precisely the experience of this awakening. Receding waves of half-caught swirling vision, memories of home, the steamer, the boat, the airship, the forest. At last, all sinking away, one after another, till my eyes were wide open, my brain clear, and I realized what had happened. The most prominent sensation was of absolute physical comfort. I was lying in a perfect bed, long, broad, smooth, firmly soft and level, with the finest linen, some warm light quilt of blanket, and a counterpane that was a joy to the eye. The sheet turned down some 15 inches, yet I could stretch my feet at the foot of the bed freely, but warmly covered. I felt as light and clean as a white feather. It took me some time to conscientiously locate my arms and legs, to feel the vivid sense of life radiate from the wakening center to the extremities. A big room, high and wide, with many lofty windows whose closed blinds let through soft green-lit air, a beautiful room in proportion, in color, in smooth simplicity, a scent of blossoming gardens outside. I lay perfectly still, quite happy, quite conscious, and yet not actively realizing what had happened until I heard Terry. "Gosh," was what he said. I turned my head. There are three beds in this chamber and plenty of room for them. Terry was sitting up, looking about him, alert as ever. His remark, though not loud, roused Jeff also. We all sat up. Terry swung his legs out of bed, stood up, stretched himself mightily. He was in a long night robe, a sort of seamless garment, undoubtedly comfortable. We all found ourselves so covered. Shoes were beside each bed, also quite comfortable and good-looking, though by no means like our own. We looked for our clothes. They were not there, nor anything of all the varied contents of our pockets. The door stood somewhat ajar. It opened into a most attractive bathroom, copiously provided with towels, soap, mirrors, and all such convenient comforts with indeed our toothbrushes and combs, our notebooks, and, thank goodness, our watches, but no clothes. Then we made a search of the big room again and found a large, airy closet holding plenty of clothing, but not ours. A council of war, demanded Terry. Come on back to bed. The bed's all right, anyhow. Now then, my scientific friend, let us consider our case dispassionately. He meant me, but Jeff seemed most impressed. They haven't hurt us in the least, he said. They could have killed us or anything, and I never felt better in my life. That argues that they're all women, I suggested, and highly civilized. You know you hit one in the last scrimmage. I heard her sing out, and we kicked awfully. Terry was grinning. So you realize what these ladies have done to us, he pleasantly inquired. They have taken away all our possessions, all our clothes, every stitch. We have been stripped and washed and put to bed like so many yearling babies by these highly civilized women. Jeff actually blushed. He had a poetic imagination. Terry had imagination enough of a different kind. So had I, also different. I always flattered myself I had the scientific imagination, which, incidentally, I considered the highest sort. One has a right to a certain amount of egotism if founded on fact and kept to oneself, I think. No use kicking, boys, I said. They've got us. Apparently, they're perfectly harmless. It remains for us to cook up some plan of escape like any other bottled heroes. Meanwhile, we've got to put on these clothes. Hobson's choice. The garments were simple in the extreme and absolutely comfortable, physically, though of course we all felt like soups in the theater. There was one piece cotton undergarment, thin and soft, that reached over the knees and shoulders, something like the one-piece pajamas some fellows wear, and a kind of half-hose that came up to just under the knee and stayed there. Had elastic tops of their own, covered the edges of the first. Then there was a thicker variety of union suit, a lot of them in the closet of varying weights and somewhat sturdier material. Evidently they would do at a pinch with nothing further. Then there were tunics, knee length, and some long robes. Needless to say, we took tunics. We bathed and dressed quite cheerfully. Not half bad, said Terry, surveying himself in a long mirror. His hair was somewhat longer than when we left the last barber, and the hats provided were much like those seen on the prince in the fairy tale, lacking the plume. The costume was similar to that which we had seen on all the women, though some of them, those working in the fields, glimpsed by our glasses when we first flew over, were only the first two. I settled my shoulders and stretched my arms, remarking, they have worked out a mighty sensible dress, I'll say that for them, with which we all agreed. Now then, Terry Bougain proclaimed, we've had a fine long sleep, we've had a good bath, we're clothed and in our right minds, though feeling like a lot of neuters. Do you think these highly civilized ladies are going to give us any breakfast? Of course they will, Jeff asserted confidently. If they meant to kill us, they would have done it before. I believe we're going to be treated as guests. healed as deliverers, I think, said Terry. Studied as curiosities, I told them, but anyhow, we want food, so now for a sortie. A sortie was not so easy. The bathroom only opened into our chamber, and that had but one outlet, a big, heavy door, which was fastened. We listened. There's someone outside, Jeff suggested. Let's knock. So we knocked, whereupon the door opened. Outside was another large room, furnished with a great table at one end, long benches or couches against the wall, some smaller tables and chairs. All these were solid, strong, simple in structure, and comfortable in use. Also, incidentally, beautiful. This room was occupied by a number of women, 18 to be exact, some of whom we distinctly recalled. Terry heaved a disappointed sigh. The colonels, I heard him whisper to Jeff. Jeff, however, advanced and bowed in his best manner. So did we all, and we were saluted civilly by the tall, standing women. We had no need to make pathetic pantomime of hunger. The smaller tables were already laid with food, and we were gravely invited to be seated. The tables were set for two. Each of us found ourselves placed face to face with one of our hosts, and each table had five other stalwarts nearby, unobtrusively watching. We had plenty of time to get tired of those women. The breakfast was not profuse, but sufficient in amount and excellent in quality. We were all too good travelers to object to novelty, and this repast, with its new but delicious fruit, its dish of large, rich-flavored nuts, and its highly satisfactory little cakes, was most agreeable. There was water to drink and a hot beverage of a most pleasing quality, some preparation like cocoa. And then and there, willy-nilly, before we had satisfied our appetites, our education began. By each of our plates lay a little book, a real printed book, though different from ours, both in paper and binding, as well, of course, as in type. We examined them curiously. Shades of silver, muttered Terry. We're to learn the language. We were indeed to learn the language, and not only that, but to teach our own. There were blank books with parallel columns neatly ruled, evidently prepared for the occasion, and in these, as fast as we learned and wrote down the name of anything, we were urged to write our own name for it by its side. The book we had to study was evidently a school book, one in which children learned to read, and we judged from this, and from their frequent consultation as to methods, that they had had no previous experience in the art of teaching foreigners their language or of learning any other. On the other hand, what they lacked in experience, they made up for in genius. Such subtle understanding, such instant recognition of our difficulties and readiness to meet them were a constant surprise to us. Of course, we were willing to meet them halfway. It was wholly to our advantage to be able to understand and speak with them, and as to refusing to teach them, why should we? Later on, we did try open rebellion, but only once. The first meal was pleasant enough, each of us quietly studying his companion, Jeff with sincere admiration, Terry with that highly technical look of his, as of a past master, like a lion tamer, a serpent charmer, or some such professional. I myself was intensely interested. It was evident that those sets of five were there to check any outbreak on our part. We had no weapons, and if we did try to do any damage, with a chair, say, why, 5-1 was too many for us, even if they were women. That we had found out to our sorrow. It was not pleasant having them always around, but we soon got used to it. It's better than being physically restrained ourselves, Jeff philosophically suggested when we were alone. They've given us a broom with no great possibility of escape and personal liberty heavily chaperoned. It's better than we'd have been likely to get in a man country. Man country? Do you really believe there are no men here, you innocent? Don't you know there must be? Demanded Terry. Yes, Jeff agreed, of course, and yet, what? Come, you obdurate sentimentalist, what are you thinking about? They may have some peculiar division of labor we've never heard of, I suggested. The men may live in separate towns, or they may have subdued them somehow and keep them shut up, but there must be some. That last suggestion of yours is a nice one, Ben, Terry protested. Same as they've got us subdued and shut up. You make me shiver. Well, figure it out for yourself any way you please. We saw plenty of kids the first day, and we've seen those girls. Real girls, Terry agreed in immense relief. Glad you mentioned them. I declare, if I thought there was nothing in the country but those grenadiers, I'd jump out the window. Speaking of windows, I suggested, let's examine ours. We looked out of all the windows. The blinds opened easily enough, and there were no bars, but the prospect was not reassuring. This was not the pink-walled town we had so rashly entered the day before. Our chamber was high up in a projecting wing of a sort of castle, built out on a steep spur of rock. Immediately below us were gardens, fruitful and fragrant, but their high walls followed the edge of the cliff, which dropped sheer down. We could not see how far. The distant sound of water suggested a river at the foot. We could look out east, west, and south. To the southeastward stretched the open country, lying bright and fair in the morning light. But on either side, and evidently behind, rose great mountains. This thing is a regular fortress, and no women built it, I can tell you that, said Terry. We nodded agreeingly. It's right up among the hills. They must have brought us a long way. We saw some kind of swift-moving vehicles the first day, Jeff reminded us. If they've got motors, they are civilized. Civilized or not, we've got our work cut out for us to get away from here. I don't propose to make a rope of bedclothes and try those walls till I'm sure there's no better way. We all concurred on this point and returned to our discussion as to the women. Jeff continued, thoughtful. All the same, there's something funny about it, he urged. It isn't just that we don't see any men, but we don't see any signs of them. The reaction of these women is different from any that I've ever met. There is something in what you say, Jeff, I agreed. There's a different atmosphere. Well, they don't seem to notice our being men, he went on. They treat us, well, just as they do one another. It's as if our being men was a minor incident. I nodded. I'd noticed it myself, but Terry broke in rudely. Fiddlesticks, he said. It's because of their advanced age. They're all grandmas, I tell ya, or ought to be. Great aunts, anyhow. Those girls were girls, all right, weren't they? Yeah, Jeff agreed, still slowly, but they weren't afraid. They flew up that tree and hid like schoolboys caught out of bounds. Not like shy girls. And they ran like marathon winners. You'll admit that, Terry, he added. Terry was moody as the days passed. He seemed to mind our confinement more than Jeff or I, and he harped on Alima and how near he'd come to catching her. If I'd, he would say rather savagely, we'd have had a hostage and could have made terms. But Jeff was getting on excellent terms with his tutor and even his guards. So was I. It interested me profoundly to note and study the subtle difference between these women and other women and try to account for them. In the matter of personal appearance, there was a great difference. They all wore short hair, some a few inches at most, some curly, some not, all light and clean and fresh looking. If their hair was only long, Jeff would complain, they would look so much more feminine. I rather liked it myself, after I got used to it. Why we should so admire a woman's crown of hair and not admire a Chinaman's queue is hard to explain, except that we are so convinced that the long hair belongs to women, whereas the mane in horses is on both, and in lions, buffaloes, and such creatures only on the male. But I did miss it at first. Our time was quite pleasantly filled. We were free of the garden below our windows, quite long in its irregular rambling shape, bordering the cliff. The walls were perfectly smooth and high, ending in the masonry of the building, and as I studied the great stones, I became convinced that the whole structure was extremely old. It was built like the pre-Incan architecture in Peru, of enormous monoliths, fitted as closely as mosaics. These folks have a history, that's sure, I told the others, and sometime they were fighters, else why a fortress? I said we were free of the garden, but not wholly alone in it. There was always a string of those uncomfortably strong women sitting about, always one of them watching us, even if the others were reading, playing games, or busy at some kind of handiwork. When I see them knit, Terry said, I can almost call them feminine. That doesn't prove anything, Jeff promptly replied. Scotch shepherds knit, always knitting. When we get out, Terry stretched himself and looked at the far peaks. When we get out of this and get to where the real women are, the mothers and the girls. Well, what'll we do then? I asked rather gloomily. How do you know we'll ever get out? This was an unpleasant idea, which we unanimously considered, returning with earnestness to our studies. If we're good boys and learn our lessons well, I suggested, if we're quiet and respectful and polite and they're not afraid of us, then maybe they'll let us out. And anyway, when we do escape, it's of immense importance that we know the language. Personally, I was tremendously interested in the language, and seeing they had books, was eager to get at them, to dig into their history, if they had one. It wasn't hard to speak, smooth and pleasant to the ear, and so easy to read and write that I marveled at it. They had an absolutely phonetic system. The whole thing was as scientific as Esperanto, yet bore all the marks of an old and rich civilization. We were free to study as much as we wished, and were not left merely to wander in the garden for recreation, but introduced to a great gymnasium, partly on the roof, partly in the story below. Here we learned real respect for our tall guards. No change of costume was needed for this work, save to lay off outer clothing. The first one was as perfect a garment for exercise as need be devised, absolutely free to move in. And, I had to admit, much better looking than our usual one. 40 over 40, some of them 50, I bet. And look at them, grumbled Terry in reluctant admiration. There were no spectacular acrobatics, such as only the young can perform, but for all-around development they had a most excellent system. A good deal of music went with it, with posture dancing and sometimes gravely beautiful processional performances. Jeff was much impressed. We did not know then how small a part of their physical culture methods this really was, but found it agreeable to watch and take part in. Oh yes, we took part all right. It wasn't absolutely compulsory, but we thought it better to please. Terry was the strongest of us, though I was wiry and had good staying power, and Jeff was a great sprinter and hurdler. But I can tell you those old ladies gave us cards and spades. They ran like deer, by which I mean that they ran not as if it was a performance, but as if it was their natural gait. We remembered those fleeting girls of our first bright adventure and concluded that it was. They leaped like deer, too, with a quick folding motion of the legs, drawn up and turned to one side with a sidelong twist of the body. I remembered the sprawling spread-eagle way in which some of the fellows used to come over the line and tried to learn the trick. We did not easily catch up with these experts, however. Never thought I'd live to be bossed by a lot of elderly lady acrobats, Terry protested. We had games, too, a good many, but we found them rather uninteresting at first. It was like two people playing solitaire to see who would get it first. More like a race or a competitive examination than a real game with some fight in it. I philosophized a bit over this and told Terry it argued against their having any men about. There isn't a man-sized game in the lot, I said. But they are interesting. I like them, Jeff objected, and I'm sure they're educational. I'm sick and tired of being educated, Terry protested. Fancy going to a dame school at our age. I want to get out. But we could not get out, and we were being educated swiftly. Our special tutors rose rapidly in our exams, in our esteem, excuse me. They seemed of rather finer quality than the guards, though all were on terms of easy friendliness. Mine was named Somel, Jeff's Zafa, and Terry's Modine. We tried to generalize from the names, those of the guards, and of our three girls, but got nowhere. They sound well enough, and they're mostly short, but there's no similarity of termination and no two alike. However, our acquaintance is limited as yet. There are many things we meant to ask, as soon as we could talk well enough. Better teaching I never saw. From morning to night, there was Somel. Always on call, except between 2 and 4. Always pleasant, with a steady, friendly kindness that I grew to enjoy very much. Jeff said Mrs. Zava, he would put on that title, though they apparently had none, was a darling, that she reminded him of his Aunt Esther at home. But Terry refused to be won, and rather jeered at his own companion when we were alone. I'm sick of it. He protested, sick of the whole thing. Here we are, cooped up, as helpless as a bunch of 3-year-old orphans being taught what they think is necessary, whether we like it or not. Confound their old maid impudence. Nevertheless, we were taught. They brought in a raised map of their country, beautifully made, and increased our knowledge of geographical terms. But when we inquired for information as to the country outside, they smilingly shook their heads. They brought pictures, not only the engravings in the books, but colored studies of plants and trees and flowers and birds. They brought tools and various small objects. We had plenty of material in our school. If it had not been for Terry, we would have been much more contented. But as the weeks ran into months, he grew more and more irritable. Don't act like a bear with a sore head, I begged him. We're getting on fine. Every day we can understand them better, and pretty soon we can make a reasonable plea to be let out. Let out, he stormed. Let out. Like children kept after school. I want to get out, and I'm going to. I want to find the men of this place and fight. Or the girls. Guess it's the girls you're most interested in, Jeff commented. What are you going to fight with? Your fists? Yep, or sticks and stones. I'd just like to. And Terry squared off and tapped Jeff softly on the paw. Just for instance, he said. Anyhow, he went on, we could get back to our machine and clear up. If it's there, I cautiously suggested. Oh, don't croak, Van. If it isn't there, we'll find our way down somehow. The boat's there, I guess. It was hard on Terry. So hard that he finally persuaded us to consider a plan of escape. It was difficult. It was highly dangerous. But he declared that he'd go alone. We wouldn't go with him, and of course we couldn't think of that. It appeared he had made a pretty careful study of the environment. From our end window that faced the point of the promontory, we could get a fair idea of the stretch of wall and the drop below. Also, from the roof, we could make out more, and even in one place, glimpse a sort of path below the wall. It's a question of three things, he said. Ropes, agility, and not being seen. Well, that's the hardest part, I urged, still hoping to dissuade him. One or another pair of eyes is on us every minute, except at night. Therefore, we must do it at night, he answered. That's easy. We've got to think that if they catch us, we may not be so well treated afterwards, said Jeff. That's the business, Rick. That's the business risk we have to take. I'm going if I break my neck. There was no changing, Terry. The rope problem was not easy. Something strong enough to hold a man and long enough to let us down into the garden and then down over the wall. There were plenty of strong ropes in the gymnasium. They seemed to have to swing and climb on them, but we were never there by ourselves. We would have to piece it out from our bedding, rugs, garments, and moreover, we'd have to do it after we were shut in for the night. For every day, the place was cleaned to perfection by two of our guards. We had no shears, no knives, but Terry was resourceful. These Jennies have glass and china, you see. We'll break a glass from the bathroom and use that. Love will find a way, he hummed. When we're all out of the window, we'll stand 3 man high. Cut the rope as far as we can reach, so as to have more for the wall. I know just where I saw that bit of path below, and there's a big tree there, too, or vine, or something. I saw the leaves. It seemed a crazy risk to take, but this was, in a way, Terry's expedition, and we were all tired of our imprisonment. So we waited for full moon, retired early, and spent an anxious hour or two in the unskilled manufacturer of man-strong ropes. To retire into the depths of the closet, muffle a glass in thick cloth, and break it without noise was not difficult, and broken glass will cut, though not. As deftly as a pair of scissors. The broad moonlight streamed in through four of our windows. We had not dared leave our lights on too long, and we worked hard and fast at our task of destruction. Hangings, rugs, robes, towels, as well as bad furniture, even the mattress covers, we left not one stitch upon another, as Jeff put it. Then, at an end window, as less liable to observation, we fastened one end of our cable strongly to the firm-set hinge of the inner blind and dropped our coiled bundle of rope softly over. This part's easy enough. I'll come last so as to cut the rope, said Terry. So I slipped down first and stood well braced against the wall. Then Jeff on my shoulders, then Terry, who shook us a little as he sawed through the cord above his head. Then I slowly dropped to the ground, Jeff following, and at last we all three stood safe in the garden with most of our rope. Goodbye, Grandma, whispered Terry under his breath, and we crept softly toward the wall, taking advantage of the shadow of every bush and tree. We had been foresighted enough to mark the very spot, only a scratch of stone on stone, but we could see to read in that light. For anchorage, there was a tough, fair-sized shrub, close to the wall. Now I'll climb up on you two again and go over first, said Terry. That'll hold the rope firm till you both get up on top. Then I'll go down to the end. If I can get off safely, you can see me and follow. Or say I'll twitch it three times. If I find there's absolutely no footing, well, I'll climb up again. That's all. I don't think they'll kill us. From the top, he reconnoitered carefully, waved his hand, and whispered, okay. Then slipped over. Jeff climbed up and I followed. And we rather shivered to see how far down that swaying, wavering figure dropped, hand under hand, till it disappeared in a mass of foliage far below. Then there were three quick pulls, and Jeff and I, not without a joyous sense of recovered freedom, successfully followed our leader. That was chapter 3 from Erland. By Charlotte Perkins Gilman. I think if I read a little faster, I might get through the next chapter or close to it. You're listening to Goodnight Norman on WGXC.org and most of the rest of the world, WGXC 90.7 FM in the beautiful Hudson Valley, coming to you live from downtown Hudson. Chapter 4 of Hairland, Our Venture. We were standing on a narrow, irregular, all too slanting little ledge, and should doubtless have ignominiously slipped off and broken our rash necks, but for the vine. This was a thick-leaved, wide-spreading thing, a little like Amphilopsis. It's not quite vertical here, you see, said Terry, full of pride and enthusiasm. This thing never would hold our direct weight, but I think if we sort of slide down on it, one at a time, sticking in with hands and feet, we'll reach that next ledge alive. As we do not wish to get up on our rope again and can't comfortably stay here, I approve, said Jeff solemnly. Terry slid down first, and he'd show us how a Christian meets his death. Luck was with us. We had put on the thickest of those intermediate suits, leaving our tunics behind, and made this scramble quite successfully, though I got a pretty heavy fall at the end, and was only kept on the second ledge by main force. The next stage was down a sort of chimney, a long, irregular fissure, and so, with scratches many and painful and bruises not a few, we finally reached the stream. It was darker there, but we felt it highly necessary to put as much distance as possible behind us. So we waded, jumped, and clambered down that rocky riverbed in the flickering black and white moonlight and leaf shadow till growing daylight forced a halt. We found a friendly nut tree, those large, satisfying, soft-shelled nuts we already knew so well, and filled our pockets. I see that I've not remarked that these women had pockets in surprising number and variety. They were in all the garments, and the middle one in particular was shingled with them. So we stocked up with nuts till we bulged like Prussian privates in marching order, drank all we could hold, and retired for the day. It was not a very comfortable place, and not at all easy to get at, just a sort of crevice high up along the steep bank. But it was well veiled with foliage and dry. After our exhaustive 3 or 4 hour scramble and a good breakfast food, we all lay down along that crack. heads and tails, as it were, and slept till the afternoon sun was sun almost toasted our faces. Terry poked a tentative foot against my head. "How are you, Van? Alive yet?" "Very much so," I told him, and Jeff was equally cheerful. We had room to stretch, if not turn around, but we could very carefully roll over one at a time behind the sheltering foliage. It was no use to leave there by daylight. We could not see much of the country, but enough to know that we were now at the beginning of the cultivated area, and no doubt there would be an alarm. Terry chuckled softly to himself, lying there on that hot, narrow little rim of rock. He dilated on the discomfiture of our guards and tutors, making many discourteous remarks. I reminded him that we had still a long way to go before getting to the place where we left our machine and no probability of finding it there, but he only kicked me mildly, for a croaker. "If you can't boost, don't knock," he protested. "I never said 'twould be a picnic, but I'd run away in the Antarctic ice fields rather than be a prisoner." We soon dozed off again. The long rest and penetrating dry heat were good for us too, and that night we covered a considerable distance, keeping always in the rough forested belt of land which we knew bordered the whole country. Sometimes we were near the outer edge and caught sudden glimpses of the tremendous depths beyond. "This piece of geography stands up like a basalt column," Jeff said. "Nice time we'll have getting down if they've confiscated our machine," for which suggestion he received summary chastisement. What we could see inland was peaceable enough, but only moonlit glimpses. By daylight, we lay very close. Terry said we did not wish to kill the old ladies, even if we could, and short of that, they were perfectly competent to pick us up bodily and carry us back, if discovered. There was nothing for it but to lie low and sneak out unseen, if we could do it. Excuse me, I had to hydrate. But Jeff thoughtfully suggested that that very thing showed how careful we should have to be, as we might run into some stalwart group of gardeners or foresters or nut gatherers at any minute. So we were careful, feeling pretty sure that if we did not make good this time, we were not likely to have another opportunity. At last we reached a point from which we could see far below the broad stretch of that still lake from which we had made our ascent. "That looks pretty good to me," said Terry, gazing down at it. "Now, if we can't find the plane, we know where to aim. If we have to drop over this wall some other way." The wall at that point was singularly uninviting. It rose so straight that we had to put our heads over to see the base, and the country below seemed to be a far-off marshy tangle of rank vegetation. We did not have to risk our necks to that extent, however, for at least stealing along among the many rocks and trees like so many creeping savages, we came to the flat space where we had landed, and there, in unbelievable good fortune, we found our machine. "Covered, too, by Dingo. Would you think they had that much sense? If they had that much sense, They're likely to have more, I warned him, softly. Bet you the things watched. We reconnoitered as widely as we could in the failing moonlight. Moons are of a painfully unreliable nature, but the growing dawn showed us the familiar shape shrouded in some heavy cloth-like canvas and no slightest sign of any watchman near. We decided to make a quick dash as soon as the light was strong enough for accurate work. I don't care if the old thing will go or not. We can run her to the edge, get aboard, and just plane down. Plop, side our boat there. Hey, look there, the boat. Sure enough, there was our motor lying like a gray cocoon on the flat sheet of white. Quietly but swiftly, we rushed forward and began to tug at the fastenings of the cover. Confound the thing, Jerry said in desperate impatience. They've got it sewed up in a bag, and we've not a knife among us. Then, as we tugged and pulled at that tough cloth, we heard a sound that made Terry lift his head like a warhorse, the sound of an unmistakable giggle. Yeah, three giggles, see? There they were, Celis, Alima, Elidor, looking just as they had when we first saw them, standing a little way off from us, as interested, as mischievous, as three schoolboys. Hold on, Terry, hold on, I warned. That's too easy. Look out for a trap. Let's appeal to their kind hearts, Jeff argued. I think they'll help us. Perhaps they've got knives. It's no use rushing them anyhow. I was absolutely holding on to Terry. We know they can outrun and outclimb us. He reluctantly admitted this, and after a brief parley among ourselves, we all advanced slowly toward them, holding out our hands in token of friendliness. They stood their ground till we had come fairly near, and then indicated that we should stop. To make sure, we advanced a step or two, and they promptly and swiftly withdrew. So we stopped at the distance specified. Then we used their language as far as we were able to explain our plight, telling how we were imprisoned, how we had escaped, a good deal of pantomime here, and vivid interest on their part. How we had traveled by night and hidden by day, living on nuts, and here, Terry pretended great hunger. I know he couldn't have been hungry. We had found plenty to eat and had not been sparing in helping ourselves. But they seemed somewhat impressed, and after a murmured consultation, they produced from their pockets certain little packages with the utmost ease and accuracy tossed into our hands. Jeff was most appreciative of this, and Terry made extravagant gestures of admiration, which seemed to set them off, boy fashion, to show their skill. While we ate the excellent biscuits they had thrown us, and while Elidor kept a watchful eye on our movements, Celis ran off to some distance and set up a sort of duck-on-a-rock arrangement, a big yellow nut on top of three balanced sticks. Alima, meanwhile, was gathering stones. They urged us to throw at it, and we did. But the thing was a long way off, and it was only after a number of failures at which those elvish damsels laughed delightedly that Jeff succeeded in bringing the whole structure to the ground. It took me a little longer, and Terry to his intense annoyance came third. Then Silas set up the little tripod again and looked back at us, knocking it down, pointing at it, and shaking her shortcuts severely. No, she said. Bad. Wrong. And so we were quite able to follow her. Then she set it up once more, put the fat nut on top, and returned the others. There those aggravating girls sat and took turns throwing little stones at the thing, while one stayed by as a setter up, and they just popped that nut off 2 times out of 3 without upsetting the sticks. Pleased as punch they were too, and we pretended to be, but weren't. We got very friendly over this game, but I told Terry we'd be sorry if we didn't get off while we could. Then we begged for knives. It was easy to show what we wanted to do, and they each proudly produced a sort of strong clasp knife from their pockets. Yeah, we said eagerly, that's it, please. We learned quite a bit of their language, you see, and we just begged for those knives. But they would not give them to us. If we came a step too near, they backed off, standing light and eager for flight. It's no sort of use, I said. Come on, let's get a sharp stone or something. We must get this off. So we hunted about and found what edged fragments we could, and hacked away, but it was like trying to cut a sackcloth with a clamshell. Terry hacked and dug, but said to us under his breath, "Boys, you're in pretty good condition. Let's make a life and death dash and get a hold of those girls. We've got to." Okay, you've been listening to Good Night Norman. Next week I'll continue reading Herland. Here in the middle of chapter 4. Donate. Give a pledge. I'd like to thank you all for listening. It's been a very welcoming experience for me. I hope it has been for you as well. So, without much further ado,